Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to April's edition of Recuperate, your monthly art show on Arrow FM 92.7 FM, your community access radio station. This is going to be the last show for a month or two because I am going to the UK for a spell. So get your fill. I don't know what will be played in May. Maybe a repeat, maybe just some gorgeous New Zealand music. I don't know. But we'll be back in June. And I'm very excited to announce that I do have a new sponsor. So my new sponsor from June onwards will be the Top Pub, or Greytown Hotel, as it's known now, here in Greytown, the wonderful Ursula Murphy, who is the proprietor of that particular gorgeous establishment, has said, yes, I shall throw my weight behind Arrow FM's art show, Recuperate. That's great. So thank you, Ursula. Thank you to Greytown Hotel. I'm looking forward to be able to bring you news about what's going on at the Greytown Hotel. They have great live music on occasion, and they also have a rather thriving ukulele group that meets on a Friday. So I'm looking forward to bringing you more news about that from June onwards. And I'll bring you news about my holiday as well when I come back too. On tonight's show, we have a very special guest in the studio with me. I have got Thros Paradise. Good evening.
Hello.
Hello.
Nice to be here.
It's good to have you here. Thros is a local singer-songwriter. And I was keen to find out a bit more about him. So the way you do that is you interrogate people for an hour. And that's what we're going to do to Thros. So Thros, tell me, you have just been working with Campbell Neil, who I've had on the show in the past, kind of remastering some of your older work. Is that right? Would that be a...
Yeah, I know Campbell from living in Featherston. And we're fairly good friends, and he's a great musician. And I took the opportunity to use his expertise to pick up some of the songs that I've written over the last 20 years or so, which haven't been recorded, and to get those recorded down on tape for posterity and to put onto my Bandcamp website.
Great. And so tell me about your kind of musical history or your musical life, because it's kind of extended over a good number of years, and you've dabbled in many genres, punk being a big one in the, I guess, in the 80s, late 70s, 80s, would that have been?
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah. So when did you first kind of realise that you had a talent for, you know, putting lyrics down and putting music behind them?
Well, I guess when I was living at home growing up in St Albans in Hertfordshire, I was always a sort of strong poetry writer. I always enjoyed that a lot. And I was always also very interested in politics, particularly the anti-war movement. So when I was growing up in the UK in the late 70s, there was a very strong CND anti-nuclear movement, anti-cruise missile movement, which my parents were part of very strongly. So I was quite heavily influenced by that. So my kind of poetry went from sort of, you know, butterflies and trees into Kurana cruise missiles and anarchists around 1978-79, and that's when I got my first guitar, and that's when I first started putting my poetry to music and putting my first songs together, which I did in the attic room of my parents' house. I had an old two-track cassette recorder which I used to put my acoustic guitar through, and then my electric guitar, and used to mix my own tracks. And yeah, that's when it all started.
And your parents' kind of political life, as you mentioned, they were very political. Were they quite responsible for, you know, setting up an anti-nuclear group, wasn't it, in St Albans?
Yeah, I mean, at the time there was CND groups were springing up all over the UK, and my parents led the St Albans version of that group and were very active in campaigning and going on marches against the missiles that were planned to be stationed in the UK. And at the time I was also quite active myself in going on quite a lot of anti-nuclear demonstrations, including sort of breaking into nuclear missile bases and being arrested by the police and all that sort of stuff. So it was, yeah, quite exciting, quite thrilling, but also kind of, you know, very frightening at the same time. Mm, yeah. A sort of very worrying period in UK history when people really thought that there was going to be a nuclear attack from Russia at that point.
So your political work would have was directly reflecting that reality that you were experiencing at the time?
Yes, and I guess because my parents were always kind of strong socialists, and I guess my rebellion when I was young was to rebel against socialism, so I became an anarchist.
Why did you want to rebel against socialism?
I always intrinsically thought that the concepts were flawed.
Are we talking like communist end of socialism or middle of the road socialism?
Both, really. I mean, I think it's, you know, fairly obvious that sort of, you know, the hard end communism, you know, it doesn't really work properly because, you know, ultimately you end up with these kind of dictatorships and police states and people in abject poverty. But also, I mean, I think, you know, the middle of the road socialism to me always seemed like a cop-out because it was basically accepting the idea of capitalism, the idea of a monetized system where people had money, but you at the same time, you know, gave people additional rights or, you know, a good standard of living. It seemed to me the two were always bound to be kind of contradictory, that it was never really possible to have true socialism. You know, it was always a kind of benevolent kind of capitalism that you were achieving. So essentially it was still a form of exploitation, but just by a different form, by a kind of watered down kind of capitalism, which I think ultimately, you know, is what has happened to most socialist movements around the Western world. You know, they've essentially become watered down liberal capitalist systems where people kind of buy, you know, consumer goods and, you know, donate to charity. So, you know, it's essentially a kind of self-contradictory kind of system where we sort of think we're doing good, but essentially there's always someone at the end of it being exploited.
So, I mean, anarchism, I mean, that's a... Just explain what that is, because I think people use the word, but as a political movement or an anti-political movement, I'm not sure if many people would really know what that means.
Well, you know, there's different forms of anarchism. You know, there's different sort of movements over, you know, long periods of history, you know, going right back to the First World War. Allegedly, that was started by an anarchist. You know, I'm not sure if that's true or not, but that's what history tells you. No, but I think, you know, to me, those things are irrelevant. What I always have believed is that anarchism is a state of rebellion. So if you are an anarchist, then you are in an active and ongoing state of rebellion against the system, against the state, against the conventional thinking. You know, whether it's through violent means or non-violent means, you're opposing everything that is accepted as being normal. That's to me what anarchism is. But, you know, other people would argue different things about, you know, the true meaning of anarchism. But that's my version.
So how old would you have been when you entered the kind of anarchist phase?
I was about 15.
Right.
And I met a boy at school who introduced me to a band called Crass, who were a hardcore anarchist band from the late 70s, and I remember reading the single, the 7-inch vinyl single that I was given, and it had a big sort of political text on the back of it, and I remember reading it and just thinking, wow, you know, that's just everything I've been thinking, that's it, you know, that's, you know, that's what it's all about, you know, dictatorship, you know, exploitism, you know, war, violence, you know, women being abused, you know, the whole gambit of sort of horrible things, and it's like fighting against those things actively. And that's, you know, that's when I became an anarchist and decided to go into it, you know, as strongly as I could.
So 15, I mean, that's that. I mean, 15's an interesting age for, you know, boys and girls. Was it just you on your own, or did you find a group of like-minded kids at school or outside of school to kind of share this philosophy with?
Yeah, so, I mean, there was a like-minded group of kids at school who I got together with, and we became very close friends, and we formed a band called Towards Zero. And we did our first gig in a pub in St Albans when I was 16, and that was exciting. We got booed off stage by the punks in the audience.
And why? Because that interests me, because isn't anarchism and punk kind of, there's a kindred spirit going on there. Was it just that Towards Zero wasn't their kind of cup of tea? I mean, what was going on in that dynamic?
No, I mean, that's what happened in the punk days. So, I mean, right, you know, the more you were booed off stage, the more you were, you know, people threw glasses at you, spat at you, the better you were. So we kind of like, you know, ran off stage with our tails between our legs. And as we were kind of running out the door, the manager of the pub came up to us and asked us if we wanted to go back next week and play again.
That's brilliant.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, the punk movement was, yeah. I mean, that's why the punk movement, I think, is so, you know, sort of revered as a movement, because it was again, you know, trying to break boundaries and do things in the opposite way to what you'd expect them to be done.
Is it? I mean, I can appreciate the punk movement. I wasn't of an age that I could have, you know, properly participated. But is it hard to kind of do the contrary to everything that's occurring to you? Because that's kind of, you know, the traditional concept is that you play a gig and people either appreciate it or they politely don't appreciate it. Rarely does it kind of burst out into this where appreciation actually looks like non-appreciation. I mean, at the time you were an anarchist and in that punk movement, but it must have been kind of confronting. I guess that's what I'm saying. Did you as performers have to kind of alter your kind of mindset and go, oh, right, well, if they're going to throw stuff at us, they must really like us? Is that a big leap to take?
Well, the way you describe it, it sounds as if it's totally odd. But, I mean, at the time, it seemed completely normal. Mm. You know, I hung around with my friends. You know, we spiked our hair up and, you know, bleached our jeans and wore leather jackets and put studs in them, and, you know, went on demonstrations and skulked around in, you know, in the corners of, you know, housing estates, and, you know, we did a lot of kind of crazy stuff, and you know, we got involved in, you know, sort of fights and drugs, and, you know, I mean, the whole thing was quite kind of confrontational, I guess, but it seemed to me to be very normal. I mean, once I got sort of became part of the movement and met hundreds of other people and thousands of other people who were doing the same thing, then it just felt like it was a kind of, you know, a fight that was worth fighting.
Yeah, and necessary.
Yeah, a political fight that was worth fighting. And, you know, being different was, I guess, a sort of a pride, was a source of pride.
Mm. What did your mum and dad think at the time? Because, you know, they were participating in, you know, in that, you know, they were confronting the establishment as well in their own way. How did they view your punk anarchist
friends? Well, I think, you know, while I was living at home, I mean, I think they saw it as something that was sort of interesting and different and edgy and quite and a bit of fun.
Mm.
So, I mean, generally speaking, they didn't have a problem with it, and, you know, I could dress how I wanted and do what I wanted, and they weren't too worried. I guess it was just when I left home that it became more serious, because, you know, when I left home, you know, I moved to Brighton and I was living in squats, you know, for sort of 3 or 4 years.
How old would you have been then when you left
home? I left home when I was 18.
Right.
And, moved down to Brighton. And again, we like playing in bands and living in squats and going on a lot of demonstrations, you know, both violent and non-violent demonstrations and festivals and, you know, kind of, you know, really kind of going, I guess, going off the rails, you know, totally. So, yeah, I mean, that's when they got worried.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I know we haven't got any Towards Zero, unfortunately. Did you make any recordings of that music when you were?
There was stuff recorded. I mean, it was funny because the band never got to a stage where we got a record contract and went in and did recording. You know, in fact, you know, the band was relatively short-lived. And we did do, you know, quite a few gigs, mostly around St Albans, and we did a couple in Brighton. And there were some recordings, but I'm not sure what's happened to them now.
Mm.
So, unfortunately, yeah, nothing exists from that period. Yeah, I have thought about trying to recreate it. But, the track I've chosen first is a track called Snuff Movie, which is, I guess, essentially, it's about the way people kill each other and how awful that is. And I guess it reflects the kind of songs that we were writing at the time. And I've recently remastered it in sort of the closest I can get to a kind of punk style. But it, yeah, I think it'll give you a flavour of the kind of thinking and the kind of energy and the kind of kicking against the system that we were trying to get on with and do.
All right, let's listen to it. Snuff Movie. Welcome back. You're listening to Recuperate with me, Lucy Cooper, and tonight's guest is Thros Paradise, a singer-songwriter based in Greytown here in the fabulous Wild Upper. And we're taking quite a chronological trip down memory lane with Thros, and we've just played Snuff Movie, which you were explaining just before we played that track, is trying to recapture a little bit of what you were doing with Towards Zero. You moved down to Brighton. That's when your parents started to get worried about you. But you moved down to Brighton and you lived this kind of, you know, alternative and very insecure life. I mean, as you would see it now, you kind of looking back, it was, you know, had none of the trappings, does it, of conventional life. Just tell me a little bit about Brighton. What was Brighton like at that time? It's always been known as a place of kind of culture, you know, but a place that blends kind of high culture with kind of slightly more edgy stuff. Was that going on then in the 80s?
So, yeah, I moved down to Brighton in 1983. And at that point, Brighton was really interesting because it was completely run down. So the entire seafront that is now full of trendy shops and fun fairs and cafes was completely derelict. And there was nothing there. There was one pub that was kind of can't remember what it was called now, but it was the pub where all the dodgy people went. So it was full of punks and skinheads and teddy boys and drug addicts and tramps. And that was the only thing that was on at the night time down in Brighton.
Wow.
And a lot of houses around Brighton at that point were empty and were derelict.
What happened? I mean, had they
It was just a recession.
Yeah.
And, you know, Brighton was just an old, crumbling seaside town falling into disrepair, like a lot of seaside towns are in the UK. So, I mean, in that sense, it was a great place to go for us because there was all these kind of dark alleyways and derelict buildings and sort of rotten architecture and broken things. And I guess in a way that kind of fitted quite well with the kind of mood we were in and what we were trying to do and the kind of the Britain that was falling to pieces and going to the dogs, the kind of thing that, you know, we were kind of fighting against.
Mm.
So, you know, I on the day I moved down, I had my hair shaved into a Mohican and spray painted red. And, yeah, from that point on, I kind of became a fully-fledged punk and was living in squats and doing a lot of gigs and going on a lot of demonstrations and wasting a lot of time lying in bed and signing on the dole. Yeah, so, I mean, it was... Yeah, I guess it was... some people would look at it as being lazy and unproductive, but, you know, we thought that we were fighting the system and doing a good job.
Mm.
So I guess there's always two sides to every story.
Because you would have been the absolute antithesis of Thatcher's Britain, wouldn't you? Or the Britain that Thatcher would have liked to have, you know, was trying to create this kind of, you know, singular, grasping kind of nation of people succeeding in all sorts of ways. And there you are, just festering in a crumbling Victorian seaside town.
Well, I guess, you know, in some ways we would have been, you know, one of the elements of British society that the Thatcher government was trying to destroy.
Yeah.
In the way that, you know, she destroyed the hippie movement that was running Stonehenge.
Mm.
So, you know, the Stonehenge Free Festival had been running since, you know, the early 70s. Every year, you know, thousands of hippies congregating at Stonehenge and celebrating, you know, the pagan lifestyle and taking a lot of drugs and listening to music. And Thatcher destroyed it. So she was a woman who came along in 1984 and destroyed the festival scene in Britain.
Yeah.
So, yeah, when we were in a way, although we were the kind of modern version of that being punks, you know, we were part of that sort of nasty part of Britain that she wanted to destroy and stamp out. And, in you know, to a large degree, she's kind of succeeded.
Yeah. I mean, were you there that at the, what's it called, the Battle of the...
The Battle of the Beanfield.
Yeah.
No, I wasn't there. No, but I was there when the Grand Hotel was blown up by the IRA in 1985, which was interesting. And I was also there at the arms fairs in Brighton where we broke in and got chased by the police, and there was various riots that happened, and involved in lots of Stop the City demonstrations in London that, you know, got very violent, and also breaking into nuclear missile bases on a regular basis. You know, playing cat and mouse with the army and the police and getting chased around by police cars and things. Yeah, so I mean, as well as being, you know, on the dole and bludging off the system, you know, we were also very politically active.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also doing gigs. So, you know, I was, you know, playing gigs in different pubs around Brighton and experimenting with different musicians and forming different bands. And at that point, you know, the band towards era was kind of falling apart, and I was trying to pick up new threads. And so I was mentioning to you before that I started up a band with a friend who I'd met at university, and we were a very serious duo, and we were doing very serious songs about serious social issues, but for some odd reason we decided to call ourselves Bladder Complaint. I'm not quite sure why. We thought it was a little bit edgy.
Yeah.
But when we went on to do our first gig at one of the first live venues in Brighton, the compere introduced us and everyone fell about laughing, and we were very, you know, being very distressed and a little bit annoyed at the fact that everyone was laughing at us. We were trying to do this kind of very serious set. Yeah, and I guess, you know, that, you know, in terms of we did take ourselves seriously. Maybe we took ourselves too seriously at times.
Because you'd have been in your early 20s at this point? Or still in your...
Sort of late teens, early 20s, yeah.
God, so bladder complaint. Didn't last long? Or did you...
No, it didn't last very long at all. So it was, yeah, I mean, after that I kind of started writing my own songs and performing my own songs a bit more. So started to sort of develop a sort of solo career and a solo set. And it was probably shortly after that point where Brighton started to pick up. So the economy of Britain did start to pick up, you know, with the Thatcher era and all the sort of decontrols she was doing around banking and commercialism. And all the squats started getting closed down and the seafront started getting tarted up and the police started to be very heavy with us. And all the punks in Brighton moved out. And at that point, I was kind of left in a quandary. You know, do I go on the road with the travellers? Do I go to London and sort of live a punk squatter lifestyle? Or do I do something else? And that's when I decided to do something else. And that something else was go to New Zealand and sort of escape.
So how did New Zealand come into your head of all the places to go?
Well, I had some friends at university, even though I wasn't there myself, and one of them had lived in New Zealand, had grown up in New Zealand, a friend called Charles, and he told me some very sort of amazing stories about how New Zealand was this kind of like sort of idyll, and, you know, there was lots of free festivals and people drove old cars and, you know, there was no big cities and everyone smoked marijuana and everyone was very laid back and cool. And I thought, oh, this sounds great, you know. But I guess, you know, it was also, you know, I'd been living in Brighton for 3-4 years and it was quite a hard, you know, even though it was fun, I think my body needed a rest.
Yeah.
Needed a bit of escapism. Yeah, I was ready to go and do something else rather than just, you know, laze around and play music and fight the system.
Yeah. So what year did you head off to New Zealand?
So that was 1986.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah, flew into New Zealand, you know, totally green, didn't know what to expect, and landed in Auckland and, you know, just immediately fell in love with it, you know. Just, I remember all these, you know, funny things like, you know, the dairy. You know, what was the dairy? You know, in England, that's where you go and buy milk and cheese, but in New Zealand...
It's your license,
eh? Yeah. It's where you go and, you know, it's a sort of local corner shop and things like, I don't know, it just seemed very different, even though it was very familiar, it just seemed very different and everyone seemed very laid back. And I remember when we bought a car and we drove around New Zealand, we had a poster I put up in the back of the car and it had a picture of a cityscape with a flower growing out of a broken pavement, and on the poster it said, "Dare to Dream." And I remember Kiwis used to come up and ask me what it meant, and they couldn't understand what it meant.
Yeah.
And I couldn't understand why they couldn't understand what it meant. Because to me it was obvious, you know, yeah. It was this like urban degradation and a kind of, you know, there must be hope somewhere. But in New Zealand, you know, there was no huge urban decay and sprawl and, you know, and nasty drug system and overbearing right-wing government. It just all seemed very laid back and very peaceful. And, you know, New Zealand had the anti-nuclear movement as well, and had been, you know, the Rainbow Warrior and all these kind of what seemed like really cool things at the time and really progressive things. So that was all very attractive on a political level.
Yeah. So you came to New Zealand, was it for, like, I'll give it 3 months and see how I get on, or did you have a visa for a year? How did it work?
Yeah, I came for 6 months. That was the plan. And I was going to go back to the UK, and I had a return ticket and I think just a tourist visa. But, you know, things didn't quite turn out the way I expected them to. So, you know, we bought a car, a Valiant 64 station wagon, me and Charles, and we had a road trip around New Zealand. But, you know, we both met a couple of ladies and we ended up going to a lot of festivals, and I met, you know, some interesting Maori people, and I learned open E blues tuning, and I started writing a set, a new set of songs. And I was playing that with all the friends who I'd met, a whole load of Kiwis who I was hanging out with down in Motueka and touring around the South Island. And I started doing gigs. So I started doing gigs in local pubs, and it all started going really well. And people really liked the music. And I started to think about putting together some music and my first kind of solo album at that point.
Wow. So let's play another track.
Hmm.
Is there a track that kind of typifies this particular era of your interesting life?
Well, there's a few songs. I mean, there's one called Street Kids, which is about my first experiences of seeing homeless New Zealand people in Queen Street in 1986 when I arrived. Because in 1986, Queen Street was kind of all run down and quite a sort of dangerous place to go at night. And there was sort of street kids and sort of nasty looking people hanging around. And one of the other songs I wrote was a song called 20th Century Blues, which is a kind of a war song. But I remember the Maori people who I hung around with at the time used to think it was maybe perhaps about the Maori land wars, even though it wasn't. That was the way it was thought about.
Right. So we'll play both, shall we?
I think maybe just one of those.
Yep.
So maybe just try Street Kids. It's not a particularly great recording because it was recorded, you know, a long time ago in 1989. Just after I left New Zealand, but we'll maybe give it a go.
I am a black and bloody blue-eyed boy. I live on the streets with all the other kids. I see all the things that you can never see, and I know things you don't know. And I hear things you don't hear, and I see things you don't see, and I'm dreaming when you may be sleeping. Yeah, I'm dreaming when you are asleep. Someone is coming, someone's footsteps are near. You feel all the fighting and you feel the fear. There's God in your wisdom, but the system's here, and you hear things I don't hear. And you find things I don't find. And you find I'm at peace, but I'm dreaming when you may be sleeping. Yeah, I'm dreaming when you are asleep. I am a black and bloody blue-eyed boy. I live on the streets with all the other kids. I see all the things that you can never see. I know all the things that you can never know.
So that track was Street Kids, and you recorded that in 1989.
Yeah, I was actually, because I went to Australia for 3 months after New Zealand, and I had all these songs that I'd written in New Zealand, and I just wanted to get them down on tape before I kind of forgot them while I was still playing them well. So I went into a studio in Sydney and sort of whacked down a whole load of songs. It was quite interesting because I didn't have much money, so I did the whole thing live in one take. But it was quite interesting. And at the time I was busking in the tube stations in Sydney as well, which was quite fun.
Mm. So you were in Australia, and then there was a spell in Asia, is that right?
Yeah, well, in Australia, I mean, I hadn't initially planned to go to Australia, but I decided to go there because I'd run out of money in New Zealand. I was hoping I was going to earn some money. And so I went to Australia. But when I got to Australia, I met a lot of people in backpackers who'd backpacked through Asia. And in particular, I met an English guy who'd been to a monastery in Chiang Mai. And he told me some great stories about this monastery. And I just thought, wow, I've got to go there. And he was a bit of a kind of a cool dude, very laid back, you know, just a really nice guy. And I thought, this sounds like a really cool thing to do, go to a monastery and kind of learn about another culture. So I kind of decided that's what I was going to do. And I came back to New Zealand and had a bit of a tiki tour. I managed to earn a bit of money, not very much. And so I managed to get myself a flight to Singapore. And yeah, my budget was, I think, $20 a week. That was my budget, which even in 1987 was not very much. So I was really on kind of half a shoestring.
Jeez.
So yeah, arrived in Singapore and and then Malaysia, and just kind of being blown away the whole time by the culture and the smells and the, you know, the colours and the mountains and the jungle, and just kind of a real kind of, yeah, twisting around of everything I thought was real. And I started writing a lot of songs as a result. So I had my guitar and I was writing a lot of songs, and I managed to do a couple of gigs in Chiang Mai, which was quite good fun. And I got to the monastery and I did 4 months in the monastery. Yeah, learning about Thai Buddhism.
And had you done any meditation or anything like that before? Because it, you know, it's hardcore, isn't it? It's 4 months of...
Yeah, I mean, some meditation courses are very, very easy and they're designed for Westerners. But this one I went to was designed for Thai people. Mm. And consequently, it was very hard work. So you start off doing 4 hours meditation a day and you build up to 12 hours meditation a day. And then you go on to 16 hours meditation a day. And eventually you do 48 hours meditation without sleep. And it's at that point, after 3 months, that you reach the point where the Thai monks say that your karma is taken back to, is wiped clean.
Towards zero.
Taken back to zero. So I got to that point and you know, allegedly my karma was wiped clean at that point. But it was an incredible journey and very, you know, quite harrowing at a point. And
it
also the subconscious, all the subconscious memories come sort of back to the surface. So a lot of things, I learned a lot about my childhood that I'd kind of buried and forgotten about. And it was, yeah, quite a revelation. But when I left the monastery, you know, I was kind of like, it was kind of like being reborn, you know. It was like my sense of hearing was amazing, my sense of smell was amazing, my sense of vision was just incredible. I just felt like I was just walking on air.
Wow.
You know, I mean, you don't eat after 12 noon every day. So you eat between 6 a.m. and 12 noon, and then you just meditate. And it's walking meditation and sitting meditation. So you become very healthy.
Yeah.
Yeah, and very, very alert.
With the emotional stuff, you know, you said that, you know, stuff was kind of bubbling up as a result of all this meditation. I mean, are there people there to assist you in that journey? Or?
Yes, there are. There was an English monk who was there, and his job was to kind of liaise and help the foreign intake. Mm. There was about 6 of us, I think. So his job was to kind of help that process. But the interesting thing about the process of that 3 months of intense meditation is that everything is kind of prescribed and everything happens exactly according to a set of circumstances that's been worked out for like several hundred years. So all the emotions you go through, all the physical emotions, all the mental emotions, they're all expected. They all happen in a sequence that's been prescribed, and it's as a result of the physical and mental duress you're under and the meditation that you practice.
Mm.
So, you know, it's something that's manageable and something that's incredibly interesting. But, you know, I guess, you know, I was young at the time still. I was still would have been, you know, 22 or something, or 23. And it is quite a lot to take in, you know, especially if maybe you're, you know, fairly green around the edges and not particularly... well socialized, and yeah, it was quite hard to deal with at times, but also an incredible, fascinating experience.
You're listening to Recuperate with me, Lucy Cooper, and we're in conversation with Thros Paradise, singer songwriter, and it's been a fascinating journey so far. Let's have another track, Thros. What would you like to play next?
So, as part of that Asian tour, I ended up going to Japan. And the reason I went to Japan was that I had completely run out of money and I didn't want to go back to the UK. So instead, I bought a one-way ticket to Tokyo and thought, well, I'll be able to get some money there. And eventually I did manage to leave Tokyo. It took longer than I thought. But anyway, this track is called Ghosts Over Tokyo, and it's about living in Tokyo in, would have been 1988. And yeah, I was having a whale of a time. It was a real cool place to be.
Ghosts Over Tokyo by Thross Paradise. And you said that that was around 1988 that you wrote that track and you were in Tokyo.
Yep.
I mean, I've been to Tokyo, obviously not as long as you, but was it as... I just remember when I went, which would have been about 10, 15 years ago, it was the most urban place I've ever been in my life. It was so urban and so foreign. I almost felt the most comfortable I've ever felt in a foreign country because I was so totally other. You know, I was... that you kind of exist in this almost just under the radar as a European traveller. Was it like that back then when you were travelling? Was it as you know, this kind of hyper-urban experience?
Yeah, I mean, because I'd been living in Bangkok for a while and I'd met a lot of people who'd been there, I sort of felt like I had a good feel for it, you know, that kind of urban, edgy craziness of Tokyo. But I guess that one thing, you know, when I got to Tokyo, I met some really interesting people. And I met a couple of German people, and they were both Bhagwanis. So they was the Bhagwani Sri Rajneesh, you know, the Indian guru, who was into all sorts of strange stuff, you know, tantric sex and drugs and meditation. And so I was hanging around with these two guys and also a Dutch guy, and we kind of had a bit of a crew going on. And, yeah, we were living in a kind of cool part of Tokyo and playing a lot of music and going to a lot of parties. So I guess it was a big sort of urban party for me. I mean, it was very strange, Tokyo, and I've got some great memories of it. But I was just because I suppose I was with quite a tight crew of people who I got very friendly with.
Yeah.
It was quite a comfortable experience in a way.
Yeah, you had a small community around you, so you didn't feel totally lost.
No, not really, no. Even, yeah.
So did you have to come back to England in the end? Because I know you weren't, you know, all these travels would suggest that you didn't want to go back.
Yeah, so I mean, money was always a problem. So, you know, I managed to get enough money together to leave Japan and get back to England and, you know, got back to England completely broke. And then I was kind of like, went to London and I got a job as a cycle courier. And the money I was making, I put into putting together my second album.
Yep.
So I made a second album in Stockwell, and that was all the songs that I'd written during my travels, which was much more accomplished than the first album. It was like properly, you know, mixed down.
Right.
And I was really, really pleased with that. And at that point, I was sending that sort of copy off to all sorts of recording studios, hoping to get deals and stuff. But, you know, obviously nothing happened. You know, probably, you know, quite an eclectic taste and, you know, and maybe a bit of a raw feel. And there's a lot of really good musicians in the UK and around the world. It's a lot of competition. But, you know, I sort of then after that was at a loss. I was wondering why I was back in the UK. Didn't know what the fuck I was doing, you know. So I decided to go travelling again. So I did it all again. I went back to Asia, I went back to Australia, I went back to New Zealand. But this time I had a little bit more money because the cycle couriering actually paid quite well. So I was able to live better. I went to Thailand and had a really nice time there. And then I did a lot of tramping through New Zealand and did quite a lot of touring in Australia.
Is that what, because I know you enjoy tramping now, is that where you first kind of encountered this concept of tramping, going for long, long, long walks?
Yeah, it was the first time I got into it, and yeah, I guess the first trip was a bit more crazy and a bit more off the rails and a bit of a road trip, but I'd seen some things about New Zealand. I sort of thought, oh yeah, that looks cool, I want to try that. So I came back and I did, you know, I did a lot. I did Stewart Island and I did Fiordland and I did all sorts of tramps, you know, and really got into that, the whole physical thing. And that's when down in South Island, I was tramping and I met a guy who was a tree surgeon. And he started telling me about the life of a tree surgeon. And I thought, that's it. I found my career. I'm going to be a tree surgeon. So I headed back to the UK.
What was it, though, about what he was telling you about being a tree surgeon that so, you know, ignited something? What was it?
Well, I think it was the fact that it was, you know, it was doing something, you know, good for the planet. It was doing something that wasn't, you know, making money. It wasn't sort of an industrial thing. It was something that was, you know, essentially about protecting the environment, but also it had a physical element to it. So it was climbing, you know, a very physical, hard job.
Yeah.
And at that point, I was very much into physical stuff. I loved tramping. I loved running. I did a lot of sport. So it was a combination of protecting the environment and having a very physical job that was appealing.
Yeah.
So I came back to the UK, kind of slightly inadvertently, because I'd wanted to stay in New Zealand, but my visa ran out and I couldn't get an extension. So I got back to the UK and, you know, to cut a long story short, I became a tree surgeon.
And did the tree surgeon life kind of match up to what you imagined?
No, I mean, it didn't. No. So I was in a tree gang in Brighton thinking I was going to be saving trees. Actually realised I was most of the time cutting them down. And, you know, I guess that is the life of a tree surgeon when you first start working. You know, you have to go through that period of learning your trade learning the ropes.
Yeah.
And, you know, doing the physical hard end before, I guess, you get skilled enough, you know, to go into the more sort of intellectual end.
Yeah.
Consultancy end. So, you know, I guess, but I came out of that pretty quick, and I went back to university and decided to study ecology. But, you know, musically at that time, I was still writing a lot of music. I was still doing my own songs. So I'd taken the open E tuning I'd learned in New Zealand, and I was playing in Brighton, because I was living in Brighton still. I'd gone back to Brighton. But this time, you know, as a working person, and I met a whole load of new friends, and I was writing a whole load of new music. And, you know, it was much more upbeat, much more interesting, much more fun.
Yeah.
So that sort of leads me into the next track, which is Brighton Beach, which is all about living in Brighton and the kind of cool place that it is, and hanging out and having fun and, you know, enjoying life.
When the weekend comes, we'll walk in the midday sun and watch the freaks on Brighton Beach. And the girls are the best, they love themselves to death. And we just watch and we just scream. These are the days, the days of our lives. Down the lanes and smoke a J, and hand in hand we'll understand. When the weekend comes, we'll walk in the midday sun and watch the freaks on Brighton Beach. These are the days, the days of our lives.
Brighton Beach, and so that was around 1993, is that right, Thros?
Yeah, that's about right, yeah, just before I went to university, to sort of as a mature student.
And that was at Farnborough College, wasn't it?
Yeah, initially it was at Farnborough College. That's where I did my first ecology degree. That's right.
Which is where I grew up.
Mm. And you were there at the same time?
I was. And then...
Working in the cocktail bar.
That's right. And we get, look, because we've only got to 1993. I've been really fascinated. And even though we live together and we're, I in fact, married, you know, a lot of this was new to me. Didn't you know?
No. What are you talking about?
Oh, sorry. I've got you confused with somebody else. So I can get you back for another hour, can't I?
Maybe.
Quite easily. With inducements, I'm sure. That's been great. I mean, I've really enjoyed the story. I mean, it's a fascinating life. And the fact is that it's so different from anything I experienced. You know, I was brought up to boo at Maggie Thatcher when she came on the telly, but that's as militant as my childhood got. But yours, you know, you were so much more politically active than I ever was. And I always find, you know, the stories that you tell fascinating. And the music's great. So let's have you back for another hour. So that will be sometime after June, because me and Thros are taking the kids on holiday. So, are you going to take your guitar?
I don't know. It's quite difficult taking guitars on aeroplanes.
And maybe we could borrow one when we get there.
Yeah, it's that or the surfboard. Oh. I don't know. I'm not sure if I'm up for either.
This is an off-air conversation. As long as I can take 15 hula hoops, I think it's all even. Thanks so much for your time this evening, Thros. It's been brilliant talking to you. I've loved the music. It's been a great chat. I'm looking forward to kind of going from 1993 onwards sometime later in the year. Now, your music, you can get it on...
Bandcamp.
Great.
Just go to Bandcamp and type in Thros Paradise. And there's a selection of songs on there. Quite a few we haven't played tonight. And, a couple of really good ones that I really like. Sort of production pieces and raw pieces. So, yeah, go out there and discover it. And, if you want to make some music, give me a call.
Brilliant. You can get hold of him. Is it all your contact details on Bandcamp?
There's definitely you can contact me through there.
Right, yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'll put all the details on my Facebook page, and also I'll be putting this interview up on my blog, recuperate.wordpress.com. Looking forward to coming back in June, all refreshed from an amazing trip abroad. There's nothing like a two-month holiday to make you need another two-month holiday in a spa somewhere in Switzerland. And looking forward to welcoming Ursula and the team at the Greytown Hotel as our sponsor. Thanks so much for listening. Look after yourselves. You can always go on to recuperate.wordpress.com. Click on the interviews tab and you can download all sorts of interesting stuff that I've recorded over the last 3 years. Thank you again, Thros, and look forward to seeing you all in June. Take care.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.